This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today we're talking to a very interesting guest, a teenager that's made some very big changes within the industry of fire safety. Let's jump into the intro. I'll tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing a stereotype. Brought to you by RiskBlue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit subscribe, hit the bell, hit follow, whatever it is, just hit it. My name is James McPherson from Risk Fluent, and I'm your host for today. Today, like I said in the little hook, we're talking to a very interesting young man. A young man that at the age of 14 was a bit annoyed by something in fire safety, wasn't very happy. It didn't work for his lived experience as an end user. When the fire alarm went off, it didn't create a good reaction. It didn't create the solution which it was trying to create. So what did he do? Instead of just sitting around and moaned, he did something about it. And that has led to an industry guidance that is now available for you all to read. It's an amazing journey. What a great guy. So without further ado, let's jump into the conversation with Sonny White.
Wow, Sonny. Welcome to the podcast, buddy. I should actually say welcome back because we didn't go very well, technically wise. Back again, the vengeance. Yeah. How are you? Are you okay?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's all right, mate. That's all right. Thank you for coming on. Do you want to give yourself a bit of an introduction first, and then we'll get into our conversation?
Okay, so I'm Sonny. I'm 16 now, and I've done a guidance supplement for consideration, fire alarm considerations for people with sensory sensitivities.
Nice one. That's amazing. Yeah. Just for clarification, you are 16 years old.
Yes, 16, and it was being the guidance document was being done when I was 15.
So tell me, Sonny, how does a 15/16-year-old get into writing a guidance on fire alarms and sensory sensitivities?
Well, my mum works in the fire industry, and so I had an understanding about fire in general, and how things happened and why we stuck certain things in. But then I saw a special needs school, and it when they did a fire drill, and it basically went horribly wrong, and that was regarded as normal. Mm. And I didn't think that was right. And so during lockdown, I put some stuff together and it just started going from there. I did a webinar before the guidance document was out, and then it just built and built up from there to the guidance document.
So when you say it went horribly wrong, kind of define horribly wrong for me. Kind of tell if you can the story of like alarm went off, missed. Yeah.
Alarm went off, people freeze, having to be pushed out the door by teachers. One person just ran around the by the assembly point because they couldn't cope with the loud noise. People got upset. And overall, it just made people exhausted. And so instead of, whoopee, I get 15 minutes out of lesson, it's like, I don't like this, can't stop it. It's panicking, kind of. And they get concerned, and it was lots of covering ears, not liking it, and stuff along those lines.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're talking about people that kind of have sensitivities from a sensory basis, like sound noise. So if you can, and obviously respectfully, like kind of what is the target audience here that we're trying to solve this problem for? So you said like a special needs school, for example, is a really good example. Yeah.
So special needs school, but it's also, it gives you a lot of detail into the finer things such as FIDs, FADs, and sound. Those are the three key things. And it can really be taken on anywhere because people with sensory sensitivities aren't restricted to special needs schools. It's an invisible disability. And so nine times out of 10, you most likely will not ever see it until something noisily goes wrong or something flashes in front of them. And that just something knocks it out of place, is out of place, and it doesn't, and they react to it. The people with sensory sensitivities are everywhere, and it's an invisible disability. And because of that they'll be in a shop, they'll be in an office, they'll be in a flat, everything, so in a hospital, they can be everywhere, and we just don't know about it because they get on with their day like everyone else. And so when and it's not a bad thing, but it's the fact that we understand that we've got to make specific decibel reading in a certain building, but how we do that, so what kind of tone, what kind of stuff like that, that indicates what that can have an effect. And so the guidance document is kind of telling you how you can help that, what you can do to kind of mitigate the sound, the strobes, the bads, and help along that. So it's really, I've heard it being used for student accommodation, some hospitals, I think, various places, kind of just, it doesn't need to be a major change. It can just be, well, instead of telling the sounders to play this sound, we can tell them to play this sound. And it's still compliant, but it's just that, or instead of just sticking it up with its default setting, let's actually just have a think about this and measure the room, and we can turn it down by 20 decibels or something. And that will make the difference. So it's kind of, it's for everyone everywhere, but you can make the changes generally for other buildings, but then when you start getting special needs premises, this is when the guidance document really kind of takes off, and that's where it's kind of, that's its core area that it can do, but it's not limited to that core area.
Yeah. So what was before you guys did this new guidance, was there anything?
There was a document that got removed, made obsolete a while ago. That was a lot. That was a really large document. I can't remember the name of it, but that covered, I think, a few points of this. But then that got removed, and then there wasn't really anything on the market that told you how you can do this. It was up to the designer themselves. What could I do? It was up to their imagination, basically, if they wanted to do something. If they didn't want to, but they didn't have to, there was no information to make you aware of that either. And that's what it's aimed at to do, make people informed, because when people are informed, they can make educated decisions.
Yeah, I like that. And in my kind of experience with that as well, that relationship between building owner / manager, fire risk assessor and alarm engineer, it's very much like a hot potato type of game. So the building manager will say, fire risk assessor, tell me what to do. And then the fire risk assessor, depending on their level of competence, he might turn around and say, oh, the alarm engineer needs to come in and tell us what the best type of alarm for this, because they're the specialist for alarms. I'm just a risk assessor. And then the fire alarm company will go, no, the fire assessor needs to tell you what we need for this building. And then it will bounce around, and then you end up getting nowhere. And typically, in my experience, the alarms engineer will just put in the basic alarm, or or the like way over the top type of alarm, like just detectors and beacons and absolute, like they're being paid per square. Yeah. There is little kind of guidance, but also just connection, positive relationship between the two. So, you know, ultimately having this guidance might help that relationship, I think, which is really nice to see, particularly for those more higher risk, more complex buildings like special needs premises.
Yeah, especially that there is, it's not, I haven't heard of any special needs buildings that have been put in yet, but it's being, there is kind of a stage two of it coming up soon, which will be a lot more detailed within that. So it will be, so this is quite open, and this guidance document will be used to judge a few things and just kind of, this is your building, how can you do this? Because as you say, it's been bounced around in the ball game. And then once someone actually makes the decision and we stick something in, it often is we've spent 6 months already debating or something. We need it in now. We're not going to have time to sit around and consider stuff. Whereas when we just take it, when we just have a thing, we'll probably, it doesn't need to be very long, but we'll make a good system that will help people.
Mm. Yeah. I like that, mate. Which really is what we're trying to do, right? I think sometimes we might lose sight of that. So the kind of, you've touched on it. I want to make sure that we get this right. Like the two main issues we have here is just the sheer volume of sounders is just overwhelming and just response in certain people.
Yeah. So the volume of the sounders does cause does cause people to react, and that is one of the big things, is that when we do fire drills, lots of people go, well, it's fire drill, you wouldn't know if there's an actual fire, so we're not going to tell anyone. So we set the alarm off and everyone panics. But what we're not seeing is one of the things that I've spoken to someone and they said, if there is anxiety behind the fire alarm, just thinking it may go off because it's so loud. So because it's so loud, people will sit there and get concerned that someone may press a call point or they may have fire drill, and it will just overwhelm them. And basically it will eat away at them throughout the day. And eventually by the end of the day, they're exhausted. And it's like, is it going to go off today? Are we going to do it now? Is it in 5 minutes? And everyone just kind of starts to panic a bit. And because the sheer volume, it's so loud. It's as if someone's just set up a firework right next to them. And that's one of the big things. Because people with sensory sensitivities often don't like it very loud. So when you're speaking special needs classrooms, for example, they're very quiet places. We're not normally doing, let's sit and have a group discussion in three groups and it's all really loud. Even in that, it's often in a large room and we're all very quiet and we're all kept to ourselves. We're not going to need the fire alarm to try and battle against the sound because it's not that loud in the room. So if we lower the sound level to a nice quiet tone, because there's nothing's going to stop the fire alarm being heard in special needs schools because they're not loud. It's not like we're trying to do a concert hall, that they're massively loud, and so we're going to need to come up with some solution to get over that. But in special needs schools, there is no massively loud sound. In the school I saw, it didn't even do music, and so you can't even say the musical instruments are going to cause a loud noise because they did drama instead, and that's not shouting, screaming, that's acting. And so there is there's nothing to need to go over to go massively loud. And so when you do, when you set the sounders, you can then set them quieter and lower, and you can, you then will be able to, that won't cause people to react as adversely to the sound.
Yeah.
If that answers it in a roundabout way.
No, it does. It does. What, yeah, I really like about this is what I find really impressive is it is kind of trying to put us back to what a fire assessment was always intended to be, in that is a assessment of what's in front of you, the end user in that building, and the guidance is meant to act as guidance to guide through that process. Actually, yeah, very much become over the years have been, well, without getting on my soapbox, and I don't want to get on my soapbox here, I'm going to try and come up with a way to do it. But I think because of the variations in competency with fire risk assessors, there's been basically we need to follow the exact letter of the guidance and force every building to fall in line with everything when without actually holistically looking at what we're trying to do here. So, yeah. A lot of the time, you know, I'll go into a building and they'll be like, all of the doors are fire doors, for example, and they all need to be. And then you're like, actually, if you just look around at the building, like, and look at the original designs of the building, actually only 50% of these are required to be fire doors. It just so happens that they are fire doors. So we're not, there's a lack of kind of actually risk assessing, in my opinion. And using the guidance and the design drawings and so on, and your knowledge of who's in that building, who uses that building, to make risk-based decisions, which is essentially what assessment is. And what I like about the work that you've done and the team that you've been working with, it kind of tries to encourage us to go back down that route and consider who's in this building. And I always find it really, as it's a completely different type of area. And obviously you couldn't take this and take this example and put it somewhere else. But just as an example of something quite similar, when I went on a cruise for my honeymoon, and this really big induction onto the ship, and a big part of it was safety, and a massive part of it was fire safety. And so every single room in this ship has a detector on it. And if that detector detects something, we will ring your phone. And if you answer your phone, we'll ask you if there's a fire in the room. If you don't answer your phone, somebody will already be on the way to your room to check the situation. There will not be an alarm go off. And I remember just thinking about it and looking around the room, and you could tell some people were quite uncomfortable with the idea that, well, there's no fire alarm. But can you imagine if there was a fire alarm on a ship and all, God knows how many thousands of people just panicked and absolutely, you know, haywire on a enclosed steel, like, yeah, like in a massive, vast ocean, would just be a bad idea. And yeah. A very different customer base, but a very similar notion. What we're trying to do is manage a fire, deal with a fire, but without causing a panic. And it's quite similar in a way to what you're trying to do, I think.
Yeah, so I know BS 5839 Part 1 really well. I've read the sound of decibel reading very well. And so I've gone through, and it does say it should be 65 decibels, but there's no, you can go away from that. And there's a reason why we can go away from that, because the 65 dB will not always be suitable for every single building. It will be suitable for the majority, but not for everything. So for other stuff, you have to do it yourself. And I think people have forgotten some of that. And we decide that we go, it must be this. It must be in accordance with this. But actually, it doesn't have to be. It can be a bit out. It can be outside the box thinking, basically. And we can do that.
Yep. 100%, man. And that comes back to kind of what I was saying. We got to a point where we're treating guidance as and guidance combined with a fire risk assessment is to enable you to do a job. Like so many times that I kind of, we get called in to do a fire assessment and so many times it's like a heritage building, just a different example, but related to what you just said. And I always get the old fire risk assessment, and if it's available, and have a look at it. And 9 times out of 10, the fire risk assessor is trying to commit this building to the 2022 building standards, even though this building was built in like the 1600s, and you're just never going to be able to do that. And in a way, it's just, it's that same notion of like this fear of blowback on me as a risk assessor is basically forcing me to not take a risk-based approach. And maybe the variance in competency and that I think has a big impact. But you know, I'll just use one example of a shoe factory in a local town that I went to the other day. It was like, I don't know, 1800 maybe this building was built. We used to have like a terrace hatched street of houses, and then they'd smack a factory in the middle of this terrace street. A great idea for like customer, your employees living next door to workplace. Horrendous idea for just anything other than that, really. Massive building, old as anything. And it was the shoe factory years and years and years ago. Now it still is a shoe factory, except now in 2022, and building standards are very different, and fire safety guidance and legislation and standards that we expect to operate to are very different. And the last fire risk assessor pretty much wanted this factory being knocked down and rebuilt. That was the only way that you were ever going to get proper, you know, up to date, get it up to date to modern day standards. And I was like, but you have to, you can't follow the guidance because this is, you can't follow, say, like, I'm trying to think of an example, means of escape, for example, from the top floor went back into the second floor. So you were going into a protected staircase and then going back into like a hazard area to go into another staircase, which is pretty much a no-no. You couldn't change it. Like it just is what it is. Like you have to knock the whole top floor off and put a new top floor on. It would never work. So we did the risk assessment and basically just did it as a risk-based approach. And then we had the fire service in a couple of weeks later, but was just coincidentally booked in anyway. And they had the exact same response that we did and said, well, there's no way you can hold this to current standards because it's a, I don't know, whatever it was, 1800 building. But previous fire risk assessors had. And again, that's just another example, I think, of maybe the wider issues within the fire profession, which I think probably your mum could talk a lot more than I could, let alone the both of us. But, you know, I think it's a very complicated space. And that's what I really like what you've done in this guide is it's just kind of gone through your own experiences, identify the profession needs a bit of help. And you were... User have gone and done something at the age of bloody 15, which is just mind blowing.
Yeah.
Well done, mate. Well done. So we kind of spoke about the decibel level of the training. I'm kind of lowering it down, and I think one of the biggest issues we're talking about here is confidence to be able to do that, right? Yeah. We might look to the fire risk assessor, and we've kind of already spoke about that. So often I think we might look to working with the local fire service as well. I think that relationship there seems to have waned for sure. I mean, in your example at your school, were the, just curious, were the fire service involved in that conversation at all, or was the school mostly just leading that conversation?
I don't even think the school was leading that conversation. I think it was, here's the design, stick a fire alarm system in. It was all kept to the building company. Building company just knew they were building a building. They didn't know it was for, well, they may have known it was just special needs, and they may have just kept them to themselves.
Do you kind of raise the... Was there a subsequent conversation after that, or...?
So during the design, we raised I raised the thing that what about sticking your voice fire alarm system in? And so the head teacher contacted the company and they went, yep, okay, it's an extra £5,000. That's the end of the conversation, basically. We're paying £2 million for this building. No, we're not spending £5,000 on the fire alarm system, but we're spending £20,000 on a laser wood cutter. So, yeah. And then I turn up to the new building and they put probably what they could have done with that £5,000 by not sticking so many sounders in the building. Because you walked in and before you even got to your classroom, you passed about 5 sounders. And I mean, it wasn't a big building. It was, it held, I think, not even 12 classrooms. It basically had corridor up, you went off to your classrooms, and that was it, and same downstairs. And before you even got there, you passed 5 sounders, and then you walked into the classroom that was probably wasn't even, you could fit probably, it was about 6 to 8 double desks in the classroom and a space for teaching. That was about the size. And we had a cupboard that was about 1 meter by 2 meters. And within that space, we had 3 sounders. At least one was a flashing light. So we had two in the classroom and 1 in the cupboard. I don't know why you'd need 1 in the cupboard. And then the only room that didn't was the room they thought would be the learning support hub, which was this. So as it was a special needs school, all the students needed support, but the ones that needed additional support were in the learning support hub. But of course, the learning support hub wasn't actually in that room when they moved in. So they were in the room that had too many sounders, and the classroom that and the other room that they thought would be the learning support only had 1 sounder, which 1 sounder would have been enough to cover the whole, each classroom at least.
Jesus, that, I'd say that's surprising, but in my experience of building buildings, it's not surprising whatsoever. It's kind of indicative of the industry at the moment. It's disappointing in a way. You mentioned kind of voice alarms there. I think a lot of people don't realize that there's a lot of sites that you as a customer, so like a big shopping center, for example, and have like a pre-alarm, and sometimes that's well, like a pre-alarm's gone off and they might say something over the tannoy like, can Mr. Smith go to parking bay 1? And everybody knows that what that actually means is there's a fire in zone 1, or the alarm's going off in zone 1. Can you go and check it's an actual fire? I think again that not a lot of people know that they can utilize things like that within the guidance to be able to see if it's a real fire. We see this quite a lot in hospitals, the alarm's going off. Right, we want a 2-knock system, so we want the first knock, go and check. And then the second knock means, okay, we've got a proper fire now. Now we go into evacuation mode. Voice alarms, you could then take that the next step further, and that sounder could actually be a voice. And I think the first time we spoke, did you even say, was it yourself that said something about I'm like a Thomas Tank Engine kind of tune? Or was that you that said that, or somebody else has told me that?
Nursery rhyme tune. So, yeah, there's places. Voice sounders are when you've got to pick the right model. So different companies do different things for their voice sounders, and they have different components built in them. And so you need to pick one with the right components built in. I always think it's best to, before you stick it in, actually come and hear it. So buy one, wire it up yourself, and just listen to it and see, could you sit there for 10 minutes and listen to that sound and not be annoyed? And if it's a yes, then that's a good one to stick in. If it's a no, that's the drawing board. I think I've heard of one place, a nursery, that stuck a nursery rhyme on the sounders, on the voice standards, and all the kids just walked out, and all the, because it was staffed, all the staff knew that that was the fire alarm, so they'd just get the kids. Instead of upsetting what would be probably 20 kids in a room and causing mayhem and then crying, you just played a nice tune, and the staff would know that and walk them out. And you could do some of the same kind of things in a special needs school, except you probably wouldn't need a nursery rhyme. You could just speak it. But when you speak it, you've got to speak it in a certain way. You can't be too, you don't want to be too direct. You'd want to say it nice and calmly and clearly, but not firm. You just want to say, please leave the building by the nearest available exit. And special needs schools are staffed it's probably about one staff to six students. It's about roughly that. And a classroom is never normally bigger than 12. And that would have, and that if it was 12, be regarded as a large classroom. And so there would probably be a teacher and an LSA in there. And so you then, if the alarm went off, you'd have two members of staff who could direct students if they didn't understand the voice message. And so therefore you've got trained people in there, but you shouldn't, personally, I wouldn't say you should rely on students to be trained. You should rely on the members of staff, because people react to fire alarms different ways depending on how up are they. So if they're really tired, they may not be as quick as if they weren't so tired and stuff like that. If they're having a bad day, it may not go so well. And so things like that. So you can use voice sounds quite a lot. And one of the other things is with the pulse alarms. So secondary schools, even in special needs secondary schools, you do get people coming up and pressing the call point, and that causes anxiety, and also waste 10 to 15 minutes of a lesson. And now lessons aren't too long, so that can be in some cases one third of the lesson gone. And so you lose out on teaching time. So there is a site manager on site. So why don't you put a delay on the system and just let the site manager know? And all of a sudden we've prevented 200-300, in some cases, even 1,000 students being evacuated and wasting what could be 10, 20, 30, even 50 lessons, 15 minutes of 50 lessons.
Yeah, you could tell the difference in our schooling that we used to purposely set the alarm off just before geography so that we didn't have to go, or we at least got 15 minutes off. You can tell my school was a different type of needs, more like discipline needs. It wasn't great, but to be fair, geography was boring as shit. Anyway. I think there's lots of interesting stuff that you kind of said there, and it really kind of demonstrates the real flexibility that we actually have here. Even one very simple thing is to quickly and safely get everyone out of the building as quickly as possible.
It's not like the technology is not already there. When you put an addressable fire alarm system in, even though it will give you the location, that some of the systems have been put in some of the biggest buildings in the country, and you've got it in a building that's got about 60 people or 200 or 300, and it's exactly the same technology as some of the biggest buildings. So why don't you utilize that and make it so that it does have a delay, or it does give you an alert prior? I've heard of one school that what would happen is the fire doors would shut when the fire alarm's activated. It would give it 3 minutes, and after that 3 minutes, then the alarm would go off and everyone would evacuate. And during that 3 minutes, all the fire doors would be shut. And so so staff may know, if they know that if the fire door shuts, there is a possibility of being evacuated. Then the site manager can go and check the cause of the alarm and see whether there is an actual need to leave the building. Because most schools have fire doors already put in nearly everywhere, And so if there is a fire, it will probably be contained, or the teacher will go press a manual call point.
Yeah. And again, that just shows the importance of the fire risk assessment for you to be able to take a zoom out on the lens and have a look. Okay, yeah, so we can do kind of like kind of what you're talking about there is kind of like an adaptation on like a progressive horizontal that you might use in a hospital. But I think people that have never worked in, say, somewhere like hospital where those two knock systems are actually really common, maybe you've worked in manufacturing and all you're used to is the alarm goes off and everybody gets out, this might sound a bit like, oh my God, why would you do that? Like, there's a fire in the building, you're not going to tell everybody. So it feels kind of, if you've never experienced it, it might feel counterproductive, but actually it's productive in a way that it's managing it and doing it more effectively. So again, when I used to work in the NHS, we used to have that in a lot of our hospitals. First knock would be a detector going off, and that would immediately notify the facility staff and all the fire doors would shut. So we can, if there is a fire, it's contained to your point within that zone, or within that compartment, but the facilities team are notified immediately to go and investigate. So they would go to the panel, find out where it is, and then start making their way up to that building. And they had, I want to say seven, but that feels like a long time. But we did have some really big hospitals. But anyway, have a couple of minutes, basically, or a few minutes to go and investigate. If they exceeded that time, the alarm went off and they'd started their progressive horizontal evacuation. If they saw signs of fire, they could hit a manual call point and that would act as a second knock as well. And that would act all sounded. Or if another detector in a different compartment, but a different, like room one and then room two detector, that then counts as a second knock as well, and it goes off. So basically what you're doing is you're telling the system to look for signs of a real fire, and you're telling humans to look for signs of a real fire before we freak everybody out and everybody panics. Now, the reason we do that in healthcare is because we've got people in bed. We don't really want to move unless we really have to. And then we're in one of the hospitals, we had people that if we moved them, it was like a potential risk to their life because they were that gravely ill. So it was like, we are not moving this person until the last resort. It does feel weird if you've never been exposed to that, doesn't it, I think?
So anyone who's watched Paddington Station 24/7, so like railways as well, you'll see that they have a control room, and behind them is the fire panel with basically an LCD display, or like your clock, and it will just change. The timer will just count down, and they'll have 3 minutes on the clock, and they'll radio to the staff on the ground, and they'll go and check it before they evacuate what could be 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people. And it is, and if you commute in and out of London, or any major station, you've probably heard, can Inspector Sands please go to platform whatever? And that's basically a coded message. And there has been a notification that there may be a fire. There's no guarantee that it may be a fire, but there's no guarantee that it will be a fire, but it may be a fire. And so during that 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes that they have, they will go and investigate before they chuck everyone out. And it seems silly that the smoke detector's gone off. Why are we still all sat in the building or walking around the train station? Well, it's actually because that it may not actually be a fire. The likelihood is it's not, because everyone is so aware and alert now what could cause a fire, that we are quite clear on how we can prevent fire. And so often it's somewhat in schools vaping in the toilets, or wanting to get out a lesson, someone's pressed a manual call point, or someone has even thought that the button next to the door lets the door open. And they'll press the button, and instead of off goes the alarm, which of course then they panic because the fire alarm's going off, and they can't actually figure out how to get out. It's actually, it doesn't actually do anything, so I'll go find another way. And someone's on its way, on their way down to sort out the call point before they chuck out thousands and thousands of people.
Very true. So I'm interested in the journey of this guidance then. So this you had this evacuation, this drill, you kind of noticed there was a bit of an issue there.
Yeah.
Where did you go from there? Were you talking to the school first? Did you go home, have a chat with your mum about it, look at, and then go off and try and find guidance? Like, talk me through that kind of journey.
First, I saw all the problems that go on, and then I went, had a chat with my mum, and basically, I didn't think it was right. And so I read through guidance documents and different things and just got a brief understanding of sound levels. And then went to the school and went, well, you can have this. You don't have to have this. And they went, okay. And that was kind of the end of the conversation. At that point, I think I was around probably 14 or 13. And when you don't have to have this, and they went, okay. And it's just 14 or 13 year old who probably doesn't know very much, telling them something which they know absolutely nothing about. So kind of that way for the person there, but at the end of the day, I was only 13 or 14. And so it got left there, and we carried on with that system. Then we got our new building, and I went, we can stick this in. I went, okay, that's of course not really going to stick in. And it just went on from there, and then I looked in. And over lockdown, because I had a lot of free time because online schooling didn't really work out. I just went through British Standard 5839 Part 1 and went through and looked at products on the market. During December 2020, got hold of some fire alarm kit. Which included an open area sounder that didn't really got set off. And when it did, it was inside a cardboard box, inside another box, inside another box to dampen the sound. And because there was no need for it to be that loud, and it wasn't really able to be turned down that much. Mm-hmm. And so it then progressed to there. And then I was, my school was having a bit of change in senior management. And so kind of during that point, I was able to slide in and get some decibel readings done within the school when they did their fire alarm testing on a Monday, thanks to the deputy head. And we got on to the next part, and I went on and did a webinar with Fireco. And it was based on the school, and it wasn't said which school, but it was based on the school. And I went around, dotted around where all the sounders were, what kind of level they were set at, were they set at high, low, and what was where. And so I then presented that to people, and then we, I think it was about 60 people, and we then grew from there. Onwards from there onto a guidance document, and then it started to get looked at, and the FIA then finally said they publish it, and then it kind of went from there. And then the next stage is kind of starting shortly. That's looking to be started in January officially. And that will be looking in more detail at specific places where the guidance note can be incorporated, and what, because the guidance note is very open, what exactly can you put in? So details of kind of fire alarm kit parts and what you set them to and different things like that and the options around it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's just a sheer level of determination there.
It was kind of just one step at a time, and it just kind of progressed just slowly, but it was just one step at a time, and it was never the end goal. It's kind of, do you want to do this? Yep, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Next thing. Oh, yep, that's a great idea. Let's go on that. And it's kind of just been, let's just work along this for a bit. And then an opportunity pops up, and it's kind of, let's go and do that. It's kind of like jobs. You work for one company, and another company pops up, and you go over to them. Yeah.
Well done. Wow. Yeah. I just hear of a 14, 15-year-old lad on a Zoom call or in a boardroom or whatever with a load of old fire engineers and risk assessors, just like talking about guidance, and then there's you, like this 15-year-old lad. Like, I love it. Amazing. And what I really like about this is, I talk about it a lot on the podcast, is safety's maybe getting a little bit better at it, but I'm not sure fire is really touching on this. And Grenfell's kind of highlighted it. I don't know, Jill Koenig about this a lot, as you know, talking to that end user. So in housing, it was talking to the residents, from a grand example. In healthcare or NHS, it's talking to the patients and the nurses and the ward managers and so on and so forth, and really get an understanding of what that end user experience is. And, you know, posh academic people call that kind of building that kind of cognitive diversity of, you know, really different ways of thinking and solving problems and dealing with situations. And essentially, you have just kind of forced the industry to like be like, you know, here, have some cognitive diversity. What you're doing is not working for me. It's not working.
Yeah.
Some people like me. You need to do something. Okay, you're not listening. I'll tell you what, I'll do it myself. Thank you very much. Which I love. And I'm really proud of the industry as well that's kind of supported you in that. Like, you know, we've not gone, how old are you?
Yeah, lots of people have been really understanding at how I'm only 16. I don't know everything, but I give a good shot at learning about it.
But you know your lived experience, and that no one can take that away from you. And vital information for like people like me, I'm doing the fire risk assessment for your school, for example. I'm your lived experiences with the fire alarm, because it helps me do a better job. What you've done here and what the industry has done by supporting you in that is enable us to show the benefits of understanding the end user and their lived experience with fire, to enable us to just do our jobs better, which I really like. Really, really.
Yeah.
Love it, mate. Love it. Well done, you. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Let me quickly look up my notes to make sure we've covered everything. So who was in the room? Really? Not people, but like people that were in the process of the... So you mentioned you had the FIA in there. And then I'm going to stab a guess. Your mum was probably part of the process. What about the fire service? Were the fire service involved, or the National Fire Chiefs Council maybe?
Hang on. I've got rules. So, Jake, Derek, Elizabeth, Grant, there were just different people contributing different things to what do they think about it, and what have them bit their experiences. And it wasn't just people who do firearms; it was people who from different areas of fire. So peeps, what do they do? And so how does a fire alarm affect a peep? So I know there was, because of the fire alarm, peeps were having to be made, which is kind of counteractive, because the fire alarm was causing the problem. So then you're having to create peeps, and it's not really how it should work.
It's a little bit like that, actually. Yeah. So it would have been fine if we'd have made, if we'd made the building work for the people that are in the building, we wouldn't have peeps for all of the people in the building.
Yeah. yeah, that is kind of how it should be. And along with the people who've helped me, FireCo was one of the big ones. They let me do the webinar. I was quite, no one really knew me at that point. And it was kind of, that was the first thing. And nerve-wracking as anything, presenting a presentation in front of everyone. But it was also thanks to Matt at Millward Services that got me asked FireCo, and they let me do it. Without him, I wouldn't have actually got a webinar done. So thanks to him. And it's kind of, there's lots of people who have kind of helped along the way and just got their points. It's kind of, they get their points across and then I take it on board, and it's kind of like, then that makes me better at understanding different scenarios, because they know different scenarios and I know different scenarios. If we put them together, it becomes even better. Yeah. And that's kind of what is needed if you listen to what other people have to say. And sometimes it may be nonsense, but very rarely, if it's sounding like it's that you don't quite understand, there's probably another factor in why they came up with that decision. That why did you stick that in? It's completely irrelevant for these people, but it's completely relevant for these people. So it's kind of getting that balance as well of, we're needing this for this group of people, but not for this people. Is it still safe? Yes. So we can actually accommodate these people, even though it may not be necessary for these people. Mm. And it's just helping accommodate more and more people into the picture.
Wow. You're a very wise head on your shoulders. Very wise.
Yes. Well, but I just pick things up as I go along. It's like, just listen to what other people have to say and then carry on. I was known in my school as, I knew quite a lot about what was going on. You just pick stuff up as people mention something. Oh, and completely irrelevant for that minute. But half an hour later, that's completely relevant and really useful. So it's kind of just making sure that you remember the information, because you may not need it for 3 or 4 years, but that one moment you do need it, it is really relevant.
Do you go back into school now and be like, you know who I am?
No, I've just finished year 11, so I'm on long summer holidays at the moment. It was quite, because I don't know how it kind of happened, but a lot of the year 7s pick up year 11's names and people around the different schools. And the more that teach, and I was one who always went and did the jobs. And so year 7s that I never knew, or year 8s or year 9s, and they'd know my name. And it was kind of like, and so you don't walk into a room going, do you know who I am? It's, you're walking into a room with half the people knowing your names already. Because when the teacher goes, yes, Sonny, and it's, everyone knows my name. So it's kind of, oh my goodness. It's kind of a shock, because you don't expect, you just carry on with your day and you don't expect that those 10 students all know my name. And it was kind of, I saw my tutor who does life skills, so teach people how to go on a bus, do cooking, stuff like that, health and safety, stuff like that. She was out at the bus station doing a group, and they all knew me. I had absolutely no clue who half them were. And it's kind of, and it was like, I know you, I've seen you, I have no clue who you are, but they all knew me. And I was just going over and having a chat with my old tutor. But that is kind of, it's surreal that everyone knows me.
Yeah. Awesome. That's absolutely, yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
So the guidance is out now. It's available.
Yes.
I'm going to put it in the description. Yes. I don't think you could make it. I think you were doing your exams, if I remember rightly, but it was,
yes,
the expo this year, wasn't it?
Yes. FireX. FireX this year. We were checking dates of different things and pulling up exam board information And it just so happened that on the day of the release, I had an exam literally a couple of hours before, and I'm not in London, so trying to then get up there straight after. It wasn't really the best idea, because of course then I had an exam the following day as well. So it was just better to stay in school and relax, but also learn more for the next exam. Yeah.
But you did a Zoom call in and presented to the audience.
Yeah, so we did a pre-recorded video, and trying to read off a script while a video camera was recording you. I think it was about 20 takes before we came with the final one, but we got there, and it turned out really well. In the end, the guidance was released, and everyone can now get hold of it.
When you do you feel proud of what you've done? Do you when you look at that guidance and when you hear people talk about it, you know, I'm a 31-year-old fire risk assessor, and I've been trying to become really competent for a long time. And there are people that have been doing it a hell of a lot longer than me that will now pick up your guidance, help them do their job. Does that make you feel quite proud of what you've done?
Yeah, I'm really happy that other people are now going to be able to just pick up some extra knowledge to help others. And it's one of those shock moments where you're just thinking, oh my goodness, I've just released a document that hundreds of thousands of people are going to read and hopefully affect millions of people, hopefully, by the end of it. And it's kind of, you just get those kind of shock moments. It's like when I was doing my exams, it's like, oh my goodness, I've been at this school for 5 years and now I'm doing GCSEs. It's like, it's kind of, you just carry on with your day, and then it's like, it like slaps you in the face. Oh my goodness, I'm actually doing this. Hits you in the face, sorry. Yeah.
It's amazing, mate. It's amazing. Yeah. That guide will, you know, no matter how many times it's updated and tweaked, and it will always have started with you not being happy with what's in there and deciding you want to try and do something about it. I just think there's a lovely moral to that story, but I think you should be very proud of what you've done, mate. You know, obviously a lot of other people in that journey that should also be proud. But ultimately, if you'd have just accepted the status quo and gone, no, you know, they don't think about us, and just moaned about it.
Yeah.
Would have happened, but actually turning around and trying to do something with it, I think is hats off to you, mate. You should be very proud.
Thank you. I never do anything the simple way, but often it ends out a really good way.
Really good, mate. And I'll put the guide in the link as well, so people can get hold of that. But well done. I mean, any other guides you're planning on doing next? What's next for the sunny? Obviously, fire, or are you like, I've had enough of fire now, I want to do something else?
So there's talks at the moment with people on doing another kind of document which uses the FIA document as the baseline and what we can do to help other places that are already built and or in design, and more specifically giving kind of more precise information. It's not currently nothing quite there yet. We're still just waiting on just figuring out and hoping that it will all go through. We've asked, and it's being considered as we speak at the moment.
Having discussions
it should be really good.
Well done, and that's really interesting. So there's more to the. I watched this space for Sunny White, then basically in the fire space.
Yes, watch this space. There'll be more coming out hopefully in the next couple of months, if maybe a bit longer, depending on how long it takes to do the next thing if it gets approved.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Mate, well done. I sense great things to come. So thank you very much for the work that you've done and the work that you will do. And thank you very much for coming on the podcast and having a discussion with us. Sorry, the first attempt didn't work out. If you'd have heard the audio, mate, it was horrendous. It was so bad. But it was both of us. So mine was bad as well. I don't know what we fixed mine now, I think.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Nobody can understand anything. But thank you for coming back on and thank you for being patient with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, peeps, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. What an amazing young man, an inspiration to us all, I think, to, you know, if we're frustrated by something, then do something about it. Don't just sit around, moan and groan at the pub or whatever, or put out a little social media post moaning about stuff to make yourself feel better. Go and change it. Do what Sonny did. He was 14 when he started this journey, and he has now got to a point where he's issued out or at least started the journey, and it's resulted in industry guidance. And I think there's loads more to come from Sonny, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what else he does in his future. And I thank him very much. I thank you all for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Don't forget, if you need any support with this stuff, RiskFluent has quite a lot of background in fire safety, so you can drop us an email if you want, james@riskfluentltd.com. Otherwise, go to riskfluentltd.com, and our new website is there for you to learn anything and everything about what we do. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.